This is Justice Radio. I'm Catherine Besteman, an abolitionist educator at Colby College and the coordinator of the Freedom in Captivity Initiative. Today, I am really looking forward to taking a deep dive into Maine's challenges with meeting our constitutional obligation to ensure that everyone who is charged with a crime has legal representation. At issue in Maine is the state's lack of compliance with the Sixth Amendment, which states, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witness in his favor, and this is the important part, to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. Right now, Maine is in violation of the Constitution and is facing lawsuits over the state's inability to ensure due process to those charged with crimes. To talk about this situation today, I'm really delighted to welcome my guests, Annie Greenbaum and Robert Ruffner, two lawyers with the Maine Indigent Defense Center. So to begin, let's get to know you both for a minute or two before we dig into the sort of meat and potatoes of our topic today. Annie, we'll start with you. What brought you to your current work as a defense attorney representing people charged with a crime who don't have the resources to hire their own lawyer? Why do you do this? Why are you here?
I always picture myself doing criminal defense. Even when I was just starting to look into law school, I really couldn't picture myself doing any other type of work. I wanted to be able to work with individuals. I wanted to be able to work with people. I wanted to make sure that people knew they were seen, that they were heard. I wanted to be able to also educate and advocate for them. That's really what's kept me going since I started doing this in 2016, is the reward that you get to feel when people do feel like they've actually been heard, been seen. This is not a process that anybody wants to go through. Nobody is meeting me really on their best day. But when they feel like they actually have someone listening and advocating for them, that really keeps you going every day.
Great. Thank you. Rob, I'm going to shoot the same question to you. Why do you do what you do?
I came to it a little bit differently. I originally thought I was going to be getting my PhD in economics at the same time as I was getting my law degree. I applied to programs where that was an option. But right when I was studying in grad school economics, I realized I didn't have the math for a PhD in economics. So that sort of went out the window. But in law school, I was very interested in criminal law, but thought I was going to be doing prosecution, primarily when there was a tragedy off campus at Washington University in St. Louis, where two undergrads were carjacked and killed. And I decided that that was it. I was only going to be applying to work at district attorney's office, which I did. I also applied to the public defender's office in Missouri, but was hired by the district attorney's office, or the circuit attorney's office in St. Louis, where I worked for a little over 2 years and ended my rotation there before coming to Maine in the domestic violence unit. In Maine, they opened up the first domestic violence unit in Portland, and I was one of the two attorneys that staffed that when it was opened. I worked there for a little less than 2 years and left the DA's office wanting to do criminal defense and some other work. And within a matter of months, I realized all I wanted to do was criminal defense. In terms of focusing on indigent defense, it really evolved over time. Although in Maine, for most defense attorneys who aren't OUI specialists, you do a fair amount of indigent defense if you're only doing criminal defense. The more I did that, the more I found things that were broken, not just within our society or the justice system, but within how Maine was providing counsel and also what they thought of counsel and our lack of independence. And so in 2007, I decided to form the Maine Indigent Defense Center, which until a year ago was basically just the name of my advocacy efforts to reform the system. Last year, we made the decision, Attorney Greenbaum, Attorney Slayton, and I, that we would just do indigent defense. We didn't really do retained criminal at all, but we were just going to do indigent defense and then under the name of the Maine Indigent Defense Center. And we've been doing that since late May or June of last year. And we've gone from three attorneys to now there's nine attorneys in our office doing just indigent defense. at the state level.
Thank you. I'm going to continue this line of questioning because I'm really interested in the Maine Indigent Defense Center. I'm curious if you can sort of walk us through how you do your work. How do you get your clients? Who pays you? What's your relationship with the Maine Commission on Public Defense Services? Can you kind of, you know, situate Sure. your office in that context?
We receive our cases individually through, like every other attorney that does indigent defense work that isn't a public defender. We now have public defenders in Maine for the first time, barely 2 years old, but every other attorney is a private attorney that's assigned cases from the court. And that's how we get our cases. So our relationship to the commission and to getting cases is the exact same as hundreds of other attorneys that do this work. And so there's no special relationship there in terms of the work we do. We don't receive any special treatment or anything like that.
So one of the issues I wanted us to talk about is the need that the Maine Indigent Defense Center fills in terms of the landscape for defense in Maine, because Maine has been much discussed in our local newspapers for its failure to meet our constitutional obligations. We don't have enough attorneys willing to offer pro bono defense or defense, you know, that's compensated by the court. Until 2 years ago, we didn't have any public defender office at all, making us, as I understand it, the only state in the entire country to lack a public defender's office. And so I'm curious if you, and Annie, I'll come to you to start us off here. It's quite striking that Maine, until 2 years ago, was the only state that didn't have a public defender's office. And I think because this has been normal in Maine, it's been hard for people in Maine to understand why this matters. Why should we care that we don't have a public defender's office? Why should we care that we don't have enough lawyers willing to take cases from the court? Why should we care if eventually people will end up before the court and end up with a court-appointed attorney after maybe, you know, spending a little bit more time in jail than perhaps one might like? But why is this such a constitutional crisis? Annie, can you start us off?
It's really understandable that some people may not even understand why it's important. A lot of people assume that they'll maybe never interact with the criminal justice system, and nobody really wants to. Reality is that really anybody could wind up in the courtroom that Rob is in or that I'm in and need a lawyer, and they may need a court-appointed lawyer. That Maine is not a very wealthy state. A lot of people here need a court-appointed lawyer, and it could be anybody. So it really matters that it is something that everybody's aware of, understands that this is going on, because it really affects everybody and anybody, because anybody could be in need of these services. We are trying our best to just fill as much as we can of that gap as best we can from being defense attorneys, but we're only so many attorneys. We can't take every single case. We do a lot of lawyer of the day work. So we are seeing people when they have their first appearances with the court, when they're asking the courts for attorneys, and we're seeing how that's affecting people as well, the delays that they're seeing, how long someone may end up going without an attorney. We can't always predict that. And so we're doing our best to help them on those individual days. But then how long may they go without an attorney? We can't even begin to predict that.
And why does that make a difference? Again, why should we care about that? I mean, you know, eventually the system will play itself out and people will end up in court and they'll make their pleas. And so why does it matter that we provide people with attorneys in a speedy way, that they have attorneys at all? Rob, can I come to you to help us with that?
Absolutely. I want to come back to the not enough attorneys thing eventually, but why is it important? We assume, society assumes, a large percentage of the time that the right outcome is the product of the criminal system, that there's going to be appropriate charges brought, that they will be tested at trial or in a hearing, and the right outcome will happen and then an appropriate punishment will be handed down. That assumption it's very, very flawed. But that assumption, that model only exists if the accused has the benefit of a skilled, trained, and not overburdened attorney who can, from the very beginning, from the time that right attaches, which is your first appearance in court, is able to begin to advocate for the client and preserve and develop evidence and defenses and challenge the state's theory of the case, But also, and here's the thing, the work that's seen in the movies and in the books, it's not exciting. Getting to really know our clients and to be able to advocate for them as whole people and to explain that this is a human being, this is an individual, and they may be here because they're innocent, because they're wrongfully accused, but they may also be here, as is far too often, because of unmet needs, needs that our society purports to meet or attempt to meet, but hasn't. The reality is that many of them are in the criminal system as a result of the impact of their of unmet needs, whether it's substance use disorder, housing issues, cognitive issues, mental health issues. Those drive close to 90% of the cases that we see. And if you don't get to know your clients, if you're not able to develop that, and for a person stuck in jail, it is very difficult to wait so your attorney can track down records or a caseworker you had years ago or other documentation so that you can get an appropriate outcome when you could just, I'll just plea it, just let me out. It's very hard for, and we're not able to second guess that opinion, that choice for the client when they're the one stuck in jail. So any delay not only impacts whether we even convict the right people of the right crimes and that the right punishment for the right crimes has been handed down, but whether the clients are actually exercising a free choice to accept a deal. And our notion of the system assumes that all those things are happening. And without it, it's even more flawed than I think some people already know that it is.
This is Justice Radio. I'm Catherine Besteman, and today we're talking with Annie Greenbaum and Robert Ruffner of the Maine Indigent Defense Center. Thank you so much, Annie and Rob, for sort of summarizing the constellation of issues that make this such a pressing matter in Maine. I there are a couple of things I wanted to kind of harp on or bring back to the surface in what you just said, because I think they're really important and worth restating. The first is that the lawyer's responsibility is to go beyond just ascertaining guilt or innocence. Did that person do it or didn't they? To contextualize the act of harm that happened, to try to provide a broader narrative, a broader understanding of the context in which somebody may have perpetrated a harm, and thus to help illuminate what are the structural factors, what are the contextual factors that may need to be taken into account when determining not just guilt or innocence, but appropriate consequences. And I think that's such an important, the humanization of the criminal legal system and the important role of the lawyer in building that. And then the other thing that I heard you say that I think is really important, and I want to make sure our listeners catch it, is the tendency perhaps, the propulsion built into our criminal legal system of people to accept a plea deal just in order to get out of jail. And if they don't have a lawyer available to them who's willing to run down the witnesses and, you know, look into their history, the longer they're sitting in jail, I heard you to be suggesting, perhaps the more willing they might be to take a rotten plea deal just to end it and move on. And so to have the availability of a lawyer who they know they can count on to do that work for them would perhaps make the context a little bit more equitable. So I'm curious whether, I guess this is kind of a follow-up question. Is there equity in our system right now? Do you think our criminal legal system in Maine is running equitably? Does it provide equal access in ways that are fair for people? How maybe if you could point out the ways that it offers fair and just assessments and the ways in which you feel that we are failing to do that could be helpful for our listeners. Rob, I'll start with you and then we'll turn to Annie.
I don't think it's fair and equitable. It occasionally, despite the way the system is structured, that can be achieved through sometimes by luck, but often by attorneys advocating for their clients, even having a breakthrough in negotiation and understanding with a reasonable prosecutor that even an agreement that is just and equitable and fair can be reached. But it's not by design. There aren't guardrails that ensure that is going to happen all the time, or even the majority of the time. Without a skilled attorney with the time and ability to do that advocacy, it's really by happenstance and luck. And even then, you may not have a prosecutor who is what we might think is reasonable in order when, even if you have all that information and material, it's not guaranteed that you'll have a receptive audience on the other side, and nor is it always received the way we hope by the court. It ought to be. I always blame myself if it's a question of advocacy to the court, and it doesn't happen. I wouldn't necessarily say the court, individual judges are not fair, but I don't think I could, as a participant, I'm too close to it. And I always wonder if I could have done better for a client when we don't achieve that. But it's not a fair and equitable system. And I think that is why we do this work, because it's not easy. It's not guaranteed. And it is rewarding when we get, as Jenna Zoislak, Attorney Zoislak in our office describes it, a sliver of justice. She has a whiteboard and she writes down her slivers of justice that she achieves. And I think that's a good term for it, because individual attorneys, when we achieve that for the client, it may be the whole world at that moment. But we recognize that we've achieved one tiny sliver of justice for this, that overall that day. And it's one of the most rewarding things is when a client, no matter the outcome, the appreciation they show when they know that an attorney is as invested in their outcome as they should be, in terms of the effort that's made, their availability. We get that response, not always with successes. It's the clients definitely appreciate just the act of caring and advocacy from an attorney. And that has an important impact on how I think that client views the outcome in whatever benefits that are supposed to come from the decision by the court and the judge. If they feel that they had an advocate and they were heard, I think whatever supposed benefits we were supposed to get from the sentence, it has a shot at that point. If someone receives the exact same sentence, but felt that they were not heard and their attorney didn't care and they were just, we're not going to see, I think, the same sort of positive outcomes, statistically speaking, I would assume.
Thank you. That's really helpful. My next question is perhaps a personal one, that, if you are working, laboring really to afford proper representation, caring, humanizing representation within a system that you have defined as unjust and inequitable, how do you deal with the failures, the failures of the system when you know the outcome is not perhaps what you had hoped for and not perhaps what it should be? I'm sure all lawyers have to live with the burden of those cases that didn't get an equitable outcome. And I'm wondering how do you manage that within your office? Annie, I'm going to come to you first to help us understand what that might feel like, because if you work in an office where you're devoted to this sort of representation and it is, as I said, within a system that is fighting against it, how do you manage that emotionally, psychologically, et cetera?
That is one of the benefits of working in this office and having a defense bar like we have in Maine. You have access to other attorneys that are doing this work. You have access to supports and people that can just sort of commiserate with you when that happens and understand it. And you try to not take it as sort of a personal failure. You do the best you can in every case for each individual person. Every person's case is important to them. And you have other people that are supporting you that you can go to. Maybe they've got advice for the next one to say, hey, yeah, I had something really similar happen in a case. And, you know, I've been trying to do XYZ since then. And I've found that helps. The main defense bar is really fantastic and does a really great job of supporting each other as well. And being there to educate attorneys, be there to help each other, support each other, especially for that kind of stuff. It is really hard and can take a toll if you're not sort of watching out for that, watching out for yourself and making sure to take those sort of breaks and taking a look at that when you need to.
Rob, how about you?
I think it's important to use those experiences, which happen a lot when you're a defense attorney, to always never phone it in. You know, the worst thing that I can imagine is when it doesn't go our way, we wonder if there's more we could have done, if we could have done better. But if you know that there was more that you could have done going into it and it didn't turn out the way you were hoping, that shouldn't happen. And I think that those losses are an important reminder that we need to make sure that we've done everything we can as advocates so that even if we don't win, there wasn't a thing we were aware of that we could have done better. Now, we're always learning and we invariably can do better the next time, but it's through the learning process, not because we didn't give it all that we could. And also I agree with Attorney Greenbaum that this office is really great because there's 9 of us here of the attorneys doing this work, and we are able to share our frustrations and our road bumps as well as our victories. And that is not only great in terms of preparation in making us better advocates, but in terms of helping us sort of mental health wise. Occasionally I've been known in the office to speak in my native language of trucker, pirate, sailor loudly, which is just enunciating. But, you know, being able to be around people that understand what you're going through and where you're coming from and to help provide perspective is really great. I've received calls from a number of attorneys in our office and even outside of the office, but to speak about the wider bar, and when they are really grappling with a client that's in distress, because most of the problems our clients have, we can't solve. You know, the unmet needs are the real thing, and sometimes it reaches a crisis point, and too frequently, we're all they've got. There isn't a caseworker. There isn't somebody else out there which is what they really need: a psychiatrist, a caseworker, someone helping them with the housing program, a job coach. But we're all they've got, and we feel that pressure. And I've received calls multiple times on weekends and at night, and I've made those calls as well. And being there to support each other, I think is important and keeps us sane.
Thank you. To wrap up the show, I want to talk sort of broad picture again to what in your utopian dreams, or maybe even let's just say your progressive, realistic dreams, what would we need in Maine to be able to ensure that everybody charged with a crime has the appropriate defense counsel and support structure that they need for ensuring that they are supported through what is often a very scary and horrific process. Our defense structure in Maine is dependent upon a network of lawyers, which is dwindling in number, and pretty low payments for those lawyers. Best case scenario, what has to change? Rob, go ahead.
Well, I think it's important, and I will answer the question about the myth that we don't have enough lawyers. One way of looking at the problem when there's people that need an attorney and don't have one is just go, oh, we don't have enough attorneys. But we have 45% more cases pending than we did in 2019. 74% of them are felonies. In 5 years, we haven't had 50%, you know, 45% increase in defense attorneys. And what we need is to stop dumping all of society's problems into the criminal system. It is the easiest place to deal with the symptoms of poverty, the symptoms of homelessness, the symptoms of mental health and substance abuse. It is the worst way to solve any of those problems. It is not a way to solve any of those problems. And that takes up a lot of resources. So one of the things we need to do is to properly recognize the issues in society that we are trying to address and to have an honest conversation about where is it best and how is it best to address those issues in society. And if we did that, there's a whole lot of cases would never be brought into the system whatsoever. I think also, though, we need a chief public defender. We need an advocate that she can speak for the criminal system from the defense perspective, has the authority to do so in the sort of recognition the way the attorney general's does or the prosecutor's association does, so that she can engage in conversations with the prosecution and the legislature and the governor to how to systemically bring about some of those changes, in addition to for the cases that are where they are, should be in the system, that they're properly and fairly addressed, that the all the attorneys have the support and training and experience they need for the type of cases they have, and there's the level of support and mentoring. That's one of the things we're still very much lacking, is that role. And but it is a dangerous myth to say that we don't have enough attorneys. We have too many cases. We're handling more cases than ever before and doing more work per month than ever before. We have too many cases.
Thank you, Rob. Beautifully, beautifully articulated, and certainly in accord with abolitionist understandings of what we need to be doing to reduce the number of people flowing into the system, which is to augment our ability to meet basic social needs and to address problems that we're facing as a society with regard to the housing crisis and problems with substance use disorder and our incapacity for offering support to people who are dealing with mental health challenges and severe poverty, among other things. Using prisons to solve those social problems is a pathway to hell. So I'm deeply grateful to both of you, Annie Greenbaum and Robert Ruffner from the Maine Indigent Defense Center, for joining Justice Radio today. With thanks to bluesman Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series, and to Luke Brown and Aaron Pyle, our sound engineers, we are Justice Radio.
Thank you for having us.